from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the United Kingdom is poised to become the first nation to legalize making a baby with DNA from three people. The parliamentary vote this week is aimed at preventing mothers from passing on what can be devastating genetic diseases to their kids. But critics say it creates a slippery slope toward genetically modified children. We'll discuss the science and the ethics behind the procedure and whether the U.S. could follow Britain's lead. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. British lawmakers are shaking up the fertility medicine world with their vote earlier this week to legalize a process of making a baby from the genetic material of three people. The procedure involves replacing faulty DNA in a woman's egg that can cause sometimes life-threatening mitochondrial diseases in offspring with that of the healthy DNA of a donor woman. Proponents say it ends the suffering of couples yearning for the chance to have healthy babies, while opponents worry it tampers with genes that will be passed on for generations and could lead to so-called designer babies. The process still needs further approval from the UK House of Lords to become law there, but if approved, more countries, including the US, could be next. Joining us in studio to talk about the science and the ethics of the procedure are Hank Greeley, director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences, and he's a law professor at Stanford University. Welcome, Hank Greeley.
Thank you. Good morning.
We're also joined by Marcy Darnofsky, executive director of the organization the Center for Genetics and Society in Berkeley. It's a nonprofit group working to encourage responsible use of new human genetics technologies. Welcome, Marcy Darnofsky.
Thank you.
Thanks to the two of you for joining us in studio. And joining us by phone is Dr. Marcel Cedar. She's professor and director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at UC San Francisco. Welcome, Dr. Cedars.
Thank you.
So I'll start with you, Marcel Cedars. This is a procedure that's aimed at helping people with mitochondrial diseases. Can you tell us a little bit more about what those diseases are and what impacts they have?
So the mitochondria are organelles or small cells within a cell, or they're process basically that provides energy to make cells work. They're basically the power behind how cells work. And different cells have different amounts of mitochondria, but all cells need this to produce the energy to have normal function. And people who have diseases that affect the mitochondria, the diseases are quite variable, but they frequently involve the muscle that obviously needs a lot of energy, the brain, the respiratory system. So they involve key organs in the body that require a lot of energy. And so if this energy producer is faulty, then they can have serious and frequently life-threatening complications from these diseases.
Yes, my understanding that the woman's story in the UK that helped propel this vote had lost seven children to mitochondrial disease?
Certainly that's possible, yes.
And so what exactly does the procedure involve?
So the egg basically has the nucleus, the DNA that we think about that makes us who we are, our hair color, our eye color, all our ethnic gene traits are in the nucleus, in the DNA. And then there's the machinery of the egg called the cytoplasm, which is chock full of these mitochondria. And so in the process, and there's several different ways to do it, you can either take the nucleus, the DNA, out of an egg or an embryo from a woman who has affected disease and put it into an egg or an embryo of a woman who's healthy. So you're using that machinery of the cytoplasm.
And that woman's nucleus has been removed.
And that woman's, yes, thank you, and that woman's nucleus has been removed so that the egg or embryo can accept the new nucleus or DNA material.
I see.
The other option, and this is what's being used at the, or Oregon Primate Center is to take out actually just the spindle and the DNA, and again, in place that in an egg that has had its spindle and DNA removed, put it in the new egg, and then fertilize that egg and go through the in vitro process. So basically what you're doing is you're taking the mother's DNA, the nuclear DNA that makes us who we are, but you're transferring it into a new cell that has normal machinery. And mitochondrial DNA is transmitted exclusively from the mother. So all the DNA is going to come from that egg that goes to the child. We don't really get mitochondrial DNA from our fathers.
So essentially, because you're getting mitochondrial DNA from a donor woman, you're not actually getting, and not her nucleus, you're not actually getting any features of the third donor or what we understand as features, correct? Like eye color, hair color, height.
Correct. All of those come from the mother, from who would be the genetic mother, the intended mother, the rearing mother.
I see. So then, Hank, really, it's been called three-parent babies, but is parent then a bit of a misnomer?
I think parent's a big misnomer. I actually think parent's a misnomer for genetic parents. I think an adopted parent is a parent as much as anybody else is a parent. But in this case, you have in the nuclear DNA, the 46 chromosomes in the nucleus of the cell, about over 6 billion base pairs or letters of DNA. The mitochondrial DNA is only about 170,000. So it's much, much smaller. It doesn't have anything that, as far as we can tell, produces traits that we see, other than sometimes when it goes wrong, it produces diseases. So in a way, I think this is actually a form of gene therapy or gene transfer. The mitochondrial DNA only has about 20 genes, and so you're adding, compared to the 23,000 that the rest of it has, so you're adding a little bit of genes. You're changing 20 genes, and actually of those 20, you're probably only changing one or two of the 20 because the others will be the same between the donor and the host. And in that sense, you're swapping out a little bit of DNA. To say that's an additional parent, I think, is saying that a very small contribution is the same as the large contribution from others. The other side of that multiple parents issue, I think, is kind of interesting. I have DNA from two people, my mother and father, but they got their DNA from two people, their mothers and fathers, who got them from their mothers and fathers. I have DNA from four people, from eight people, from 16 people, ultimately from thousands and thousands of people. So if we think of anyone whose DNA we have as being a parent, we all have thousands and thousands of parents, and oddly enough, many of them are even viruses who contributed some DNA to our human genome.
But this is different from – it's been compared to IVF or – but this is different from that because it's actually manipulating on some level the genes themselves.
That's right, although one of the things that makes it different and I think more plausible in the near term, it's manipulating 20 genes or so that are in a nice little isolated package. You're not messing with the 46 chromosomes in the nucleus that contain the vast majority of the important genes. You're taking this package, the mitochondria, that has these 20 or so genes in them, and you're moving mitochondria from one person to another. So it's like taking a handbag filled with DNA and throwing it into a – taking a piece of luggage with some DNA and putting it in a house that has plenty of luggage in it already.
So, Marcy Darnofsky, do you agree it's like taking a handbag or luggage and putting it in a house?
Well, let me start by saying I agree that the three-parent is a terrible term for this. And, you know, we have lots of families with lots of kinds of parental configurations, all the better. But from a safety standpoint and from a risk standpoint and from a biological standpoint, I think the idea that mitochondria can be seen as an isolated package or a battery, which is a common metaphor that's being used, I think that's way too simplistic. The mitochondrial DNA and the nuclear DNA are in constant interaction and conversation with each other. Mitochondria do, as Marcel Seeters explained, provide power for the cell, But they also have pervasive effects, and we're learning more and more about this on metabolism, development. They can affect a range of traits, not specifically, but that's why they cause diseases in so many tissues and organs in the body. So this very mechanistic understanding of cells, where you pluck a piece out and put a piece in, I think that's actually a quite outdated and old biological framework that we've gone past.
Marcel Seeters, what do you think? I mean, does the mitochondria have a significant effect that we really don't know the full extent of, I guess, if we start to use other people's mitochondria with another person's nucleus?
I think there have been questions raised. There certainly is an interaction between the mitochondrial DNA and the nuclear DNA. But what that interaction is beyond the facilitating purpose that the mitochondria has for the nuclear DNA, and whether or not an alteration in mitochondrial DNA can actually negatively affect the nuclear DNA, I think these are things people have raised as concerns, and they're things that will need to be evaluated as we move forward. But I think a lot of the animal studies and things that have been done have been fairly reassuring in terms of what would happen in this situation.
And you were on a panel with the Food and Drug Administration back in February, is that right? And how has this been attempted in the U.S. so far? So you've mentioned the Oregon Institute and primates, but this has also been done already on some humans, correct, here in the U.S.?
Well, I think the strongest work has been done by Shukart Matalovpov at the Oregon Primate Center, where they are actually doing this spindle transfer and have had live births, and they're following these young primates out as they grow. And I think that's really the strongest work that's been done that's close to human, because animals, mice, rats, and things are much further from humans. I think that's really wonderful work. There was a situation probably in the 1990s where just taking some cytoplasm, what was called cytoplasmic transfer, was done. I believe there were around 20 pregnancies from that, where cytoplasm was taken from a younger donor egg and placed into the egg of a woman who'd failed multiple cycles of IVF.
Oh, I see. So there was sort of like a mix of cytoplasm.
Exactly. Very different process than what we're talking about in this situation.
Hank Greeley?
And that earlier process, I think, was really unfortunate. It wasn't set up as a research study, so the pregnancies weren't carefully followed, the children weren't carefully followed, it wasn't regulated in any way. It was really that process, which was being done about the same time Dolly the sheep made cloning famous, that led the FDA to say, wait a second, we think this is something that should be controlled and regulated, at least with respect to safety. And once the FDA said that in the early 2000s, things really didn't proceed in the U.S. until very recently, when the Oregon group has asked the FDA for permission to do some human experiments.
We're talking about a vote in the U.K. earlier this week to legalize the process of making a baby from the genetic material of three people, and whether the U.S. could be next. We're talking with Hank Greeley, director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford, Marcy Darnofsky, executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society in Berkeley, and Dr. Marcel Seeters, professor and director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at UCSF. Now, one of the things that's been raised around this, Marcy Darnofsky, is this idea that it could lead or open the door to, quote, designer babies. What does that mean? And do you feel like that's a real danger?
The reason there's strong concern about this is that there has been a very bright line. It's been a bright technical line and a bright policy line. And on the other side of that line, on this side of that line, are all kinds of gene transfer techniques to help people who are sick, all kinds of manipulations, cellular manipulations to help people who have diseases. On the other side of the bright line are any kinds of modifications of genes that we pass down to future generations. And that the reason that this technique raises that concern is that's the case here. This will cause irreversible changes in every cell in the body of any children who are born as a result of it, and in any future children that through the female line of any resulting children. And the concern is that once we blur that line, it's a little harder to say, okay, we're not going to go further than that. And it would be much – in the U.K., for example, the reason that there had to be a parliamentary vote was that the U.K. has a law against these germline engineering methods or inheritable genetic modifications, and they had to carve out an exception to this law. And the U.K. is like more than 40 other countries in the world that prohibits inheritable genetic modification. It's also prohibited by several international human rights treaties. But in the United States, we don't have any such law. So that's one of the reasons that there's real concern that this will, push us down that slope or throw us over a cliff.
Hank Greeley, do you agree that if we let this process happen, that there will be no end in sight?
It's not that it's inevitable. It's that it increases the pressure. It's certainly not inevitable.
Do you feel that way, Hank Greeley, that it increases the pressure at least to do that?
I think it certainly, if you no longer have a bright line, it's easier to move on down. But I don't like slippery slope arguments in general. I think we constantly live our lives on slippery slopes where we're taking one step and figuring out where to stop, what a good position is and how to lead a good life. I think this is maybe the core of the difference between Marcy and me, is this question of bright line rules. I think as a law professor, legally trained, my answer to almost every question starts with it depends. And I think inheritable genetic modifications, whether those are a good thing or a bad thing, depend on the purpose, the nature, the safety of the modification. There are some things that I think shouldn't be done. There are things like this, which gives women who have defective mitochondrial DNA their only chance to have genetic children of their own. One of the details we didn't get into is if you're a woman and you have this defective mitochondrial DNA, all of your children will inherit it. There is no way other than this that you can have a child from your own genes who does not have that mitochondrial defect and that mitochondrial disease. That seems to me a good reason to do it. If the safety proves up, and I agree with Marcy that the safety issues here are first and foremost and need to be proven, the safety moves up, this seems to me to be a good use. And I think rather than say, here's a bright line, thou shalt not do this, you should look on the other side and say, well, these things are pretty good and these things are pretty bad. And it may be that our grandchildren will draw that line differently from where we are, but it'll be our grandchildren's world by then and not ours.
Marcel Seeders, you're a practitioner. I mean, where do you draw the line, and do you see your colleagues taking this too far potentially if they're given the go-ahead to allow this type of mitochondrial, transfer procedure?
Well, I agree with Hank that you can't not do something simply because someone else might take it to a further negative place. I think that the whole premise of developing this technology is prevention of disease. And I think it has to be understood that these mitochondrial diseases have no current treatments. There really are not treatments for these diseases. And so the best way to help these families is the prevention of future disease. And I think that it's very different when you're talking about prevention of disease versus the sort of enhancement things that people have proposed might happen. I think people also have to understand how complex a lot of these other traits are: intelligence, athleticism. There are environmental inputs. There are multiple genes. There's not an intelligence gene. And so I think that the sense that people would jump so readily from a technology like this that is developed and driven to prevent disease and improve health would automatically jump to something such as what's been called designer babies or enhancement.
I see. Marcy Darnowski, you've been shaking your head.
Well, I agree with various things that both Marcel Seeders and Hank really have said, but I also disagree with other things. I think there's clearly reason to be concerned about maintaining a policy setup that many countries have put in place. If we're going to carve out exceptions, then I think we have to have a very clear understanding and policies that will protect us from mission creep, if you don't like slippery slope, Hank. And I think also we have to really be clear that we do have to look at the safety, and the safety and the policy and the ethics are all entangled here. And the primates that exist in the Oregon lab, there's a few of them. They're young still. If we were testing a new drug or medical device, that level of evidence would not cut it. And I think that there's been also some aspects of that, like when the Oregon folks tried the same technique with human material, they had real problems. It didn't work the same way as in monkeys. One other thing I would just mention at this point is that women who have mitochondrial disease, first of all, there are very, very few of them who would be candidates for this. A very small percentage of mitochondrial disease is caused only by mutations in mitochondrial DNA. And if you've got problems in mitochondria in the nucleus, you're not a candidate for this technique. It has nothing to offer you.
But when you say small percentage, I mean, even if it is small, it would help those women.
Yes. In the UK, the estimate is 10 to 15 women a year. So, I mean, that's not to say they don't deserve help at all. And that's not to say we're not very sympathetic with their situation. But here's the other thing. They have alternatives to have children and to have children who are genetically related to them even. So they have low-tech alternatives, you know, adopt a child. They have higher-tech alternatives, use conventional IVF with a third-party egg that's not been taken apart and put back together. And then they have even a higher-tech option, which is to use an embryo screening technology that is used, you know, kind of routinely now with IVF. It doesn't work as straightforwardly as with many other diseases, but many, many women who have mitochondrial disease do produce some healthy eggs, and we can find the embryos that are created from those eggs and have a child that's not affected and who's genetically related.
Cedars, a couple things. How many people in the U.S. would stand to benefit from this? Do you have a sense?
I agree it is a small number. I mean, these are rare diseases. But again, we do lots of things. There are drugs developed for orphan diseases, things that occur in very low percentages. So I'm not sure that in and of itself is a reason to do or not do something. In terms of the testing of the embryo that was just discussed, it's actually not so easy for mitochondrial diseases because very commonly the percentage of the mutated or abnormal DNA that you have doesn't always correlate with how the disease will be actualized in the person or in the child. And so it's not straightforward at all to do genetic testing on either embryos or even amniocentesis for these type of diseases.
And we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Marcel Cedars, Professor and Director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at UCSF, and with Hank Greeley, Director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford, and Marcy Darnofsky, Executive Director of the Center for Genetics and Society. We want to hear from you. What's your reaction to the UK's move? Are you gung-ho about this procedure, or does it make you uncomfortable, and why? Are you someone living with a mitochondrial disease, and how has it affected your life? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about a vote in the UK earlier this week to legalize the process of making a baby from the genetic material of three people and whether the U.S. could be next. We're talking with Hank Greeley, Director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford, Marcy Darnofsky, Executive Director of Genetics and Society in Berkeley, the Center for Genetics and Society, and Dr. Marcel Cedars, Director and Professor of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at UCSF. Marcel Cedars, a listener writes, so will the new genes that get passed on to subsequent generations, i.e., would this be a permanent fix?
Yes, they would. And that's part of what has raised concerns. And that's a little bit of that bright line that was being discussed earlier. Because all the mitochondria of a human, of an egg, of an embryo, comes from the mother, if we alter this egg, all of the females, all of the girls, all the children will have those modified mitochondria, but all of the girls will pass them on to their children. And so they will be passed on to future generations.
And let's hear what our listeners have to say. Let's go to Scott in Palo Alto. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good morning. I think it's both exciting and scary at the same time. One of your guests said, you know, the primary concern is to prevent future diseases. And I certainly understand that. But I also understand just from brushing up against Berkeley or UCSF or Stanford or MIT or Harvard, whatever it is that these institutions are both good and bad. And I don't mean bad in a bad way, but they're very much angled towards spinning off businesses and profit models. And there's nothing wrong with profit, not at all. But we need to realize that when we're talking about genetic manipulation, we are going to invariably cut corners because in the back of all of their minds, not your guests' minds, but in back of their minds is, how do I spin this off? And if you look at the culture of these educational institutions, you see right below the surface that we are looking always to, how do we make a profit off of this? So while the numbers may be small that will eventually be treated by this, I think it's I see it as more of a gateway to further genetic manipulation, which is not good or bad, but we must be very conscious of what we're doing. And it's very difficult to be fully conscious and aware when profit is right there at our heels. So I just wanted to share that comment.
Scott, thanks. Marcy Darnofsky, I see you agreeing, nodding your head to Scott's comment.
Well, I think it's a good point, and I can provide a specific example. The researcher up in Oregon, Shukrat Matalapov, who has developed some of this work and one of the techniques in particular, he's already set up a company to commercialize this, not for the prevention of the treatment of the transmission of mitochondrial disease, but to treat general age-related infertility. Now, that came up at the FDA hearing, and it was roundly dismissed. But, you know, we have, this is what I meant when I said mission creep, and I think that Scott is right in pointing to the commercial dynamics that can kick in and that we really have to look at carefully as we're evaluating the social implications.
Okay, then a couple things, Hank Greeley. Do you think that we have enough regulatory mechanism here to help relieve, to help sort of protect against pressures for profit and those motivations? And B, do you think the fact that it was even raised that this could be used, say, to treat fertility is also a sign that it's starting to already creep out beyond just mitochondrial transfer?
So I think that there will be pressures to have it creep into other areas. Anything beyond mitochondria requires a different technology, which will be more complicated, bigger safety implications, probably farther in the future. But there's a very hot technology called CRISPR involving genomic engineering, which makes me think it's not as far in the future as I would have thought 5 years ago. We do have a regulatory structure. It's not just businesses. It's not like an app on the iPhone that anybody can put up. You have to get approval from the Food and Drug Administration, and it has to be done by physicians who have some professional constraints. So it's not a perfect barrier against the profit motive. The FDA regulation, I think, is very important. And what the FDA has been considering recently is whether the Oregon group should be given permission to even do research with humans, let alone commercialize it. I will say, though, I think the U.S. and the U.K. are more different than our common language makes us think. Their regulatory structure is quite different. They have a human fertilization and embryology authority that licenses each particular clinic to do each particular procedure. So the law won't let everybody in the U.K. do this. The law will let the HFEA say, okay, Newcastle, you can do this procedure in this way. We don't have an equivalent in the United States in terms of that level of control. And I think that's something we might want to consider.
Marcel Seeders, you were on the FDA panel. Can you just tell us quickly exactly what the status is of the FDA stance on this?
So our panel's charge was really to help them think through the scientific issues and make suggestions about how we would design clinical trials. So we were really advisory. I've been on panels before for the FDA where we were a decision-making panel. This was really advisory, and so I think it's still an ongoing consideration. I think there's a key issue. There are lots of differences, as Hank Greeley said, between the U.S. and the U.K., but one of the key issues, and I think that this is part of what perhaps drives embryo research into the private sector, is that you cannot get NIH funding for embryo research. Right now in this country, and actually since the late 70s, early 80s, we've not been able to do embryo research with federal dollars. And so I think there are opportunities for greater oversight, like the UK has, but they can do embryo research in the UK. And it's regulated, but it's funded. And I think in the U.S., where that research is not allowed to be funded, it drives some of that research into the private sector where the funding is available. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. We can't be criticized for not doing the proper research if we're also not given the resources to do that.
And determining – sorry, go ahead.
And I was just going to say, once you go into the private sector to look for resources, that's where a desire for a profit motive becomes stronger.
So then how
that may be less so if you're using NIH dollars.
So then how can it truly be determined by the federal government when the technology is safe? Because it sounds like, I mean, the only way to really know would be to actually create another human being here using that process. Hank,
that's
really
part of the problem.
Yeah. And technically, where things stand right now, to use a new drug or biological device in the U.S., you have to get it approved by the FDA. To even use it in research, you have to get a sort of conditional approval called an IND, an Investigational New Drug Exemption. Right now, the FDA is considering the request from the Oregon group for such an IND that would allow them to use it in research only. It should always be a tremendously frightening thing the first time you use something in humans. And the FDA looks at how often have you used it in non-human animals, what kind of non-human animals, what kind of results. And at some point they say, there are no guarantees, but we think this looks promising enough that we're willing to let you try it in humans. When what you're trying in humans is the creation of a brand new baby, I think the level should be higher, and I think the FDA has been imposing a higher level with something that affects the rest of the life of a child as opposed to something that might affect the last 10 years of the life of aging law professor.
A listener writes, I can't think of a good reason that this, with enough oversight and regulation, should not be done. Opponents need to come up with better reasoning than playing God, and it's not natural. Let's also go to more of your calls. Let's go now to Rodney in Oakland. Hi, Rodney.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Go ahead, please.
So my question is, you know, like the previous caller said, I do think it's kind of exciting, but it does kind of have that creepy element to it. But I guess I'm kind of curious to see how can the regulators or the government or the participants guarantee that that modification is the only modification that's executed? I mean, how do you warranty that this new egg or fertilized egg is actually what we say that it is?
Marcel Cedars, do you want to take that?
Well, I think this is part of what informed consent is all about. I think whenever we are dealing with new research and new potential trials, whether it's drug trials or whether it's this kind of gene therapy, I think that relationship between the researcher, the physician, and the individual who's involved, all of that is the same if I'm giving someone a drug or we are doing gene therapy. So they're very complex issues in terms of consent. But I don't think that this is any different than any other research that would be done in terms of that, having to have that trust between you're doing what you say, you're doing nothing more, nothing less.
A listener writes, Marcel Cedars, I just want to follow up quickly. Is it whether you know how a DNA test for parentage would be affected by the process? So if someone was trying to figure out their parents, would all three DNA markers show up in the test results?
So when people are looking for DNA markers, they're looking for things from the nuclear DNA,
right.
So this would not show up.
Marcy
you have
Darnofsky.
To specifically look for the mitochondrial DNA.
Marcy Darnofsky?
Yeah, a lot of the ancestry tests do trace mitochondrial DNA. And I think, you know, I think if a child is born as a result of this technique, that child should know about it. But that's a side issue. I think one of the things to realize here is to underline what Hank is saying about this is not, we're not helping people who are suffering with this. We're not treating their symptoms. We're helping a social kind of suffering, which is an important one, a desire to have a genetically related child. But it's a different kind of thing, and I think the safety bar does have to be quite a bit higher. And I think that one of the disturbing things about the UK arrangement is that the HFEA will be licensing fertility clinics to carry this out, and there's no requirement for the children to be followed up in the UK. They explicitly omitted that requirement from the arrangement that they're making. So it's not in the context of a clinical trial, which is what is being considered, and so far which the FDA panel concluded we were too early for because we didn't have enough in vitro or preclinical evidence. And, you know, that's one of the – even though it seems that there's more oversight and regulatory structure in the UK, I think there's been some lapses and mistakes here.
I do have to take issue strongly, though, with one thing Marcy just said. The suffering of people who want children that are genetically related to them who can't have them is a real suffering and is one that I'm not comfortable saying it's greater or lesser than the suffering of people with different diseases. I do think we should pay particular attention to safety issues here, but it's because it's the entire life of a baby that will be affected. It's not because of the level or the nature of the suffering that led to it.
It's a social benefit, though. It's
Marcy
not a
Jarnowski.
Medical benefit. Yeah, and so I do think that's a different logic.
I want to share some of the thoughts of our listeners. There's been a mixed reaction. Mona writes, yes, I support this. It's a tiny fraction of DNA and can result in a healthy baby for a couple who can't otherwise have a child. Catherine says, cue the faux indignation based on religious reasons in 3, 2, 1. But John writes, designer babies, here we come. And another listener writes, this new process makes me think of the long-term practice of some cultural groups preferring a male offspring to the point of aborting the incorrect gender as soon as this can be determined. I know well a person in the medical industry who explained this practice 20 years ago. I dislike rules, but it is easy to see that this new procedure could lead to all kinds of problems, such as the problem of sex selection, leaving many frustrated males looking outside of their borders for female partners, a problem that already exists today. And a related note is about how in a world in which today there are some 35 to 70 million female Chinese babies, a listener writes, they do not exist because of low-tech genetic manipulation and untold numbers in India. I am hardly eager to see this advance in genetic manipulation of humans. However, whether the UK and US do it or not, China probably will sooner or later. And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Jeff in Sacramento. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is such an interesting area of research. Now, you know how evolution has been studied using female mitochondria to trace back the ancestry of somebody. Now, how is that going to affect that research in terms of human evolution, and how does it affect our evolution in the case of using this mitochondrial DNA process? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeff. Marcel Cedars, do you want to talk about how this could, you know, be a kink in sort of tracing history, evolutionary history?
This certainly the mitochondrial DNA will be from the donor and not from the parent. But I think we're talking about such a small number of individuals. I don't think this is going to change the course of evolution, but tracking those things in terms of ancestry will obviously be more difficult.
Yeah. Hank Greeley?
And it'll be a minor footnote for tracking history from 2015 or 2016 forward. It's not going to affect any of our understanding of the last 100,000 years of human evolution.
You know, Marcel Cedars, could I also, earlier it was mentioned that this technology could be used for fertility as a fertility specialist. Do you want to talk a little bit about whether or not this could be used for that?
So there is actually already a scientist who's working on substituting mitochondria, getting mitochondria from potentially oocyte stem cells, if they exist, and it's a bit controversial, but from the patient themselves, and to use these mitochondria to sort of rejuvenate eggs. There's a fair amount of controversy with respect to this because it's not clear. I mean, yes, the mitochondria age in the ovary, but the spindle also has problems as well. So it's not quite clear whether it might be too late in the process by the time you've taken the egg out of the body. I also think that the situation, we discussed this at the FDA panel, I think it's very, very different when you start to talk about this as a treatment for fertility, where you absolutely need control groups. You know, this is very different than the situation where you know that this mother is going to pass on these defective genes to all of her children to say, I'm going to try this as a novel strategy to improve success rates with IVF. Then I think the whole design of studies and the amount of work you need to do ahead of time are very, very different.
Marcy Darnowski, do you just want to respond to the person's earlier comment about this being a religious issue? Is this a religious issue for you?
I don't see it that way at all. And I mean, I never used the words playing God. And when I think about that phrase, actually, I'm more concerned about the playing part than the God part. That I think we have to take it really, really seriously. And we do have to apply our ethical values and our moral imagination to these issues. But it's to me and to many people, it's not a religious issue.
Hank Greeley, are you seeing this fall on conservative religious lines, or is it a mix?
I think it's really interesting in that there's both a conservative opposition to it and what I'll call a liberal or progressive opposition to it. It's almost as if the ends of the spectrum unite on this. The spectrum is almost a circle for very different reasons, but there's a lot of concern throughout the political spectrum, but it tends to be more at the conservative side and more at the very progressive side and less so in the middle.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Hank Greeley, director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford, Marcy Darnowski, executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society in Berkeley, and Dr. Marcel Cedars, professor and director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at UCSF. And Marcy Darnowski, yes, you wanted to say something?
Well, I think it would be interesting to spend a little bit of time looking at this informed consent issue that Marcel Cedars raised, because it's really an important one. You know, patients who are suffering from mitochondrial disease, and sometimes they themselves are very sick, sometimes not, but especially if they've had the experience of having a child who has been sick and suffered and died, they're in a very, you know, vulnerable situation vis-a-vis their desires for a child. And I do take those quite seriously. And they're depending on their doctors and they're depending on the researchers to tell them the full story about the risks and about the alternatives. And one of my concerns is that, you know, the scientists who are studying this, they want to help people, but they also want to make scientific breakthroughs. And they're very enthusiastic about this this new technique, and I think it's gotten a bit polarized, and I think that has hardened their enthusiasm in a way and their determination to go forward. And we've been in that situation too often before. In fact, it happened in a famous gene therapy case with a young man who died, unfortunately, in a clinical trial setting with an investigator who was too enthusiastic and cut too many corners. So I think that this, you know, I started with informed consent. We just have to be sure that women get the full story about the risks and the full story about the alternatives if this is going to happen.
But Marcy Darnowski, you know, there were many aspects of this debate as I was reading that seemed similar to the one that surrounded in vitro fertilization in 1970. And at that time, a lot of the risks were not, you know, couldn't be fully known. But now it's a procedure that's being used by millions all over the world. So at what point do we have to say, you know, without knowing for sure, we may still need to move forward because this is, you know, potentially very helpful?
Well, no, it's true. We'll never know for sure until we do it in humans. That is correct. However, typically you would require more than a few monkeys and you would not want to see the complications that have come up in any of the labs that are working on this, that have, as, at least as far as been reported so far. And what the FDA panel, the majority of the FDA panel concluded, is that
Hank
it's premature to go ahead.
Yeah, I think the science issues are – the safety issues are really important, and it'll be interesting to see what the FDA decides to do about it. You can never be entirely sure what will happen in humans until you try it in humans. But I want to go back to something one of the listeners said about sex selection.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a good example, actually. I think sex selection is very problematic and maybe something we want to restrict or ban. It doesn't really have anything to do with mitochondrial transfer, which won't affect the sex of the child one way or the other. But I think that's a nice example of, instead of having a bright line that says you shouldn't do anything, you shouldn't do, you shouldn't go beyond this line, you should look and say, well, this looks pretty good, this looks pretty bad, this looks too risky, this looks safe, and do a case-by-case consideration. To do that, you need a regulatory structure that allows you to do that, and I'm not sure ours is yet up to it, but that's the direction I would move.
And you are listening to Forum. We're talking with Hank Greeley about a UK vote earlier this week to legalize the process of making a baby from the genetic material of three people. He's with the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford. Marcy Darnofsky is executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society in Berkeley. And Dr. Marcel Seeders is professor and director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at UCSF. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. Michael from Berkeley writes, if the child is male, then the genetic change won't propagate to future generations. Marcel Seeders, do you want to answer Michael's question?
So that's true, and that was actually one of the issues brought up at the FDA panel at a point in time when we start doing the first in human studies. One of the options was, should we restrict this to only male children so that we have one generation to follow up on and not potentially have a problem across multiple generations? So we didn't reach a conclusion about that, but that was something that was brought up during the course of discussion exactly for the reason that this listener brings up.
Although the irony in that is we wouldn't then have any knowledge of how it worked in women. I mean, there's been this issue about getting enough women in clinical trials. There are some pluses to limiting it to males, but you have then the minus that if there is a differential effect on men and women, you don't see it in the women yet.
Well, there was a long discussion actually at FDA about the clinical trial design, and there was some members of the panel who were concerned that the numbers of people who would be candidates for this technique are so small that you wouldn't even actually be able to have a good clinical design.
Yeah. Well, you know— And can I just get some more clarity, Marcel Seeders, on this question of numbers? I mean, I have seen some stats that some 12,000 women in the U.S. have carry mitochondrial diseases, or that 1,000 to 4,000 babies born each year may have mitochondrial issues. So are those numbers familiar to you? I mean, do those sound about right to you?
I think one of the problems with giving a true prevalence of this disease is that it has such variable presentation, and there are so many different mutations. Those are the numbers that I've heard as well, but I think it's very, very hard to say because the way that it affects an individual and the percent of the mutant genes they have are quite variable from individual to individual and even within a single family. And so it is a rare disease, but I think knowing its full extent is quite difficult in the current technology.
A doctor called in to say that she has a son with mitochondrial disease and she lost some births. She says schools are not flexible, they don't understand needing to be in and out of the hospital, but she still does not agree with the procedure. She says society thinks we're entitled to what we want, that's injurious. Messing with genes of future generations isn't our right. Let's hear from Louise from Berkeley. Hi, Louise.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Earlier in the program, Dr. Cedar says that there's no funding for embryo research. I was wondering about the effect here in California of the 2004 passage of Prop 71 that created the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine and the $3 billion they got for research, and if any of that money can be used for embryo research. And also, the second part of the question is, what kind of structures are there for the public to have input into whether or not these sorts of exotic technologies move forward? Or is it always the case that the public hears about it afterwards and is just left to sort of comment, gee, that's nice, or gee, that's not nice? And I can take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Louise, thanks. Dr. Seeders, the Institute of Regenerative Medicine first.
Well, that's actually one of the reasons that the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine was set up, was to support human embryo research because there weren't federal dollars. And California, as well as other states, New York, Massachusetts, have set up bodies that help to fund this outside of the federal system. So that absolutely funds human research. And I think it has given us opportunities to do work I don't, not so much in this area per se, but to work with humans in a way to develop technologies in a preclinical way before we bring them into clinical care.
Marcy Donofsky, yes.
Well, speaking to the second part of the question about public input, the FDA panel, FDA actually as an agency is mandated by law to restrict its considerations to safety issues and efficacy issues. But because the issues are entangled and because the social policy and ethical issues are so consequential, those kept creeping into the hearing that was held last February at the panel. And what the FDA did was they set up a study by the Institute of Medicine, which is just now getting underway, to look at the social policy and ethical implications so that there will be some opportunity for public input through that study. And the other thing I would say is that there are public interest groups, and just, you know, to include including our own, the Center for Genetics and Society, that really welcome public input, have a big website, have lots of material on this technique and so on.
Marcy Donofsky, quickly, if this were proven safe, would you be comfortable with it? Or is it just the fact that you're entering this point where you're crossing the line where genes are involved? You just wouldn't at all? Yes or no?
High safety bar, very, very high, and need policy to restrict it to this technique if it's going to go forward at all. We need to keep a bright line.
Marcy Donofsky is Executive Director of the Center for Genetics and Society. We were also joined by Hank Greeley, Director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford, and Dr. Marcel Seeders, Professor and Director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at UCSF. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.